The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Bonjour, hi, Canada. Very serious day in Israel and India. In Israel, we have a war. I don't know what else you call that. The IDF is strafing Gaza with precise munitions at Hamas terrorists this morning. After six Israelis were killed yesterday, 35 Palestinians have been killed in the reprisal raids and bombings aimed at Hamas terrorists. Meanwhile, there was a full-scale race riot in Lod, Israel last night. And as we speak, sirens are sounding on the Gazan border, warning of an incoming barrage. Yesterday, Tel Aviv was hit, Jerusalem was hit, and anti-tank weapons were used against civilians. I wonder where they come. And Israel, anybody? So we will watch that throughout the day. And I followed it all day yesterday obsessively. I see a mobilization of 5,000 IDF, not enough for an invasion of Gaza, but six Israeli civilians is a lot for Netanyahu to put up with. And I would not be surprised. In India, the catastrophe there is simply off the charts. And COVID desperation is spreading there, according to the New York Times. Infections, death, and breakdowns that began in big cities a few weeks ago are rapidly advancing into rural areas, unleashing deep fear in places with little medical safety net. They had 3,200 deaths yesterday. And it's generally understood to be widely unreported. We will return to that, but oxygen is running out throughout the country. The national vaccine campaign is spluttering there. They've had 2 million doses administered each day over the past few days. They are getting it up to 3 million a day. They're still at about 4% of the country vaccinated. We have to rush everything there into Brazil. And this is not merely humanitarian, though it is. It is also the need to respond dramatically to a national security threat to the United States, because a vaccine-evading variant is likeliest to emerge from places like India and Brazil, where wildfire pandemic spreads. More on that in the show. In the United States, it's Jimmy Carter 2.0. We thought Joe Biden was going to be President Obama's third term. In fact, it's Jimmy Carter's second term. I can't buy gas in Northern Virginia at about 5 out of 6 gas stations. U.S. petrol stations, according to the Telegraph of Great Britain, Financial Times, excuse me, are empty, and they are in Northern Virginia. I don't know about where you live. Stocks posted their worst day on the Dow since February yesterday. Why, says the Wall Street Journal? Inflation. The Biden inflation is here. I've warned you about it. U.S. home prices, however, continue their surge, according to the Journal. Some buyers are being scared off. The prices are so high, the frenzy is so great. The median sales price for existing single-family homes higher this quarter compared to a year earlier for 182 out of 183 metro areas. That's crazy. In 89% of those metro areas, so close to 90% of the country, median prices rose by more than 10% from 1 year ago. The housing boom is widespread. It's also considered to be stable and not a bubble because there are the typical credit restrictions. U.S. job openings reach a record as hiring slows. There are 8.1 million jobs available in the United States. 8.1 million jobs in the United States. Why aren't people taking them? Because they've got great unemployment benefits. I don't blame them. It's a rationally economic decision. And in response, Governor Michael Parson of Missouri said this, cut number 17.
Despite our economy's strong comeback, many business owners and employers across the state are still struggling, not because of COVID-19, but because they can't find people to fill the jobs. To help address this labor shortage, I have directed the Missouri Department of Labor to end participation in all federal pandemic-related unemployment benefits effective Saturday, June the 12th.
The same sentiment came from South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster on Fox News last night with Tucker Cut 16.
Oh, Tucker, this is about as close to socialism as anything I've seen. The federal government's just taking over, just throwing money at people. I don't know how we're going to spend all of this. That's why cannot be done. But we're not going to take that unemployment money to pay people for not working. We got help wanted signs up everywhere.
The billionaires Peter Thiel and Alan Howard have backed a new $10 billion crypto exchange as worries continue to mount. And I had Peter Thiel at the Nixon seminar a month ago, and the cryptocurrency becoming the reserve currency is not nearly as far-fetched as it was a year ago. Meanwhile, in Great Britain, in the Queen's speech that will be read either today or tomorrow, I'm not sure, social media platforms, Boris Johnson's government will demand, that fail to protect children from harm online will face being shut down under history-making new laws to be unveiled today. It's today. In an exclusive article for The Telegraph, which can be read if you are a subscriber, Oliver Dowden, the Culture Secretary, warns tech companies that they will have no excuses. They must face the consequences if they fail to remove illegal and harmful content under a draft duty of care bill. That will rock Silicon Valley's world. Meanwhile, in Germany, Facebook faces a Germany ban because it will not, it simply is out of compliance with European law, which does not allow Facebook to harvest the WhatsApp user data, which they currently do. The Hamburg Commissioner for Data Protection and Freedom of Information issued an emergency order on Tuesday prohibiting Facebook's European operations from, quote, processing personal data from WhatsApp for its own use. Yes, they do that. If you didn't know that, you haven't been listening. You haven't been paying attention. Samantha Bowers, who was President Obama's UN ambassador, according to Joby Warwick in the book Redline, she didn't do a bad job in trying to wrestle something out of the Russians. I think the UN is one of the worst jobs you can take because you can't do anything there. But she's now heading the U.S. Agency for International Development, and she wants to do everything that can be done for India. That is great. That must be done. That must be done. Here's the worst news of the day. China poisoned the world. Then they covered it up because the communists are going to communist. Then they tried to blame the United States for the virus. Then they blackmailed countries with PPE diplomacy. They threatened the United States by withholding PPE made there but owned by us. And now it turns out their vaccine may not work. In the Seychelles Islands, 62% of the population is vaccinated. That's the highest rate of any country in the world. They thought they were well on their way to licking the coronavirus problem, according to FiercePharma.com. But last week, active cases more than doubled, raising concerns that the vaccinations aren't effective. The island nation in the Indian Ocean reported 2,486 new cases last week, with 37% of those coming from people who had received two shots. The country uses vaccines, wait for it, made in China by Sinopharm in India under a license from AstraZeneca. A similar situation exists in another Indian Ocean country, the Maldives, where the same two vaccines have been distributed. AstraZeneca works, friends. You know what doesn't work? It's like most other rapid knockoffs built on intellectual property theft is the Chinese Communist Party vaccine. Big story for news in the world. The Washington Post has named a new executive editor, Sally Busby. She's got extraordinary chops, 55 years old, succeeding Martin Baron. She had run AP, so she knows all the platforms, and her background is superb. Fred Ryan, the publisher of the paper, and Jeff Bezos led the hiring process. So, I work for the Post as a contributing columnist. I work for Fred Hyatt, not for Sally Busby, but good for the Post. And then I'm sure you'll be relieved to know that the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, Meghan and Harry, have signed a long-term global partnership with U.S. consumers good Procter & Gamble giant. I don't know what they're going to do, but they're going to do it with P&G. Cincinnati and the Royals. Who would have guessed it? Don't go anywhere, America. That's the rundown. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt on Wednesday, May the 12th. In the middle of an exploding conflict in Israel, I'm joined by Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin. Normally, I kid with Mike about what is going on in Green Bay and the fact that they're losing their quarterback, but I won't today because we do have a sort of exploding war. Congressman Gallagher, what do you make of the news out of Israel?
Well, I see it in the broader regional framework. I see this and I don't see Israel versus Hamas. I see the U.S. alliance structure versus Iran. And I would encourage everyone to stay focused on Iran, Iran, Iran. We know that Iran has a history of co-opting local grievances, whether it's the Houthi rebels in Yemen or whether it's Hamas, even a Sunni terrorist organization like Hamas, in order to draw a wedge between Israel and the rest of the countries in the region, as in order to advance their overall goal, which is the destruction of the state of Israel. And the other thing I would encourage your listeners to follow is if you think that these rockets from Hamas present a grave threat to the nation of Israel, and God bless Iron Dome and all of the scientific cooperation that led to its development, this pales in comparison to the rockets, the advanced rockets that Hezbollah has diligently built up in southern Lebanon and southern Syria over the last few years, really building what could be described as the largest military facility in the world. And what they've done is just as barbaric as Hamas. They've hid these advanced rockets under densely populated civilian areas in order, when they provoke violence, to provoke a response from the Israeli government that will have collateral damage that will invite the condemnation of the international community. It's why it's so important that the Biden administration use the authorities we gave them in the last Congress. We passed a bill authored by myself and Tom Suozzi to designate those with sanctions who are using this barbaric practice of human shields. But the Trump administration didn't designate anyone. We believe that the Biden administration can use that authority to start applying some financial pressure in order to eradicate this barbaric practice. The final thing I'd say, Hugh, is just a simple statement that, you know, a Democratic army puts itself between its civilian population and the enemy, but a terrorist army puts its civilian population between itself and the enemy. And that's what we're watching happen here.
Now, an hour ago, I spent a half hour talking with former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Dr. Michael Oren, about what is going on. He's in Tel Aviv. He spent the night in his bomb shelter. They had a race riot in Lod last night. Three synagogues burned to the ground with the Arab Israeli population turning on the Jewish Israeli population in a hitherto unknown sort of conflagration. At the same time, they haven't called up enough reserves, according to Dr. Oren, that would signal a ground invasion of Gaza. But they have killed a significant amount of the leadership structure of the Hamas military, and all's quiet on the northern front. How do you read the situation there from afar? And you're obviously going to have better sources than I am.
Yeah, I'd admit it's still hard to read it. I've been talking to some people I know in Israel over the last 48 hours. Really, it just comes down to how much Hamas wants to escalate this and thereby force Israel to take perhaps more drastic action. I just would say that now is the time for the United States to be unwavering in our support for Israel, to push back on some of these dangerous narratives that I see emerging from the American left, that Israel is somehow indiscriminately attacking Palestinian civilian populations, which, of course, we know is not the case. Hugh, I was in Israel during Operation Protective Edge some 7 years ago, and I got an in-depth understanding of how targeted and deliberative the Israeli military is and how what lengths they go to in order to avoid civilian casualties. And I can tell you that it is incredibly effective, and they would not be taking action were they not being provoked by a terrorist group. And I really do think that now is the time for the Biden administration to step back and look at the fundamental choice that they have when it comes to the Middle East. Down one path, they could just build upon the success of the Abraham Accords, enhance the really historic cooperation between Israel and the Sunni Arab Gulf states, which I actually think over time gives you your best chance to solve the Middle East peace process problem from the bottom up rather than the top down, a regionally focused approach. Or they can continue to go down this path of the Obama third term, of putting the JCPOA back together with duct tape, of believing that somehow we need to reach a new equilibrium in the Middle East by actually empowering Iran, and in some ways rejecting the Abraham Accords entirely. And that really is the fundamental choice they're facing right now. And I fear that they're rejecting the Abraham Accords in favor of reviving the JCPOA. And this is just the beginning of the chaos that we're going to see in the region as a result of it. The other thing I think we need to do is put all the information out there that is available, potentially declassifying intelligence if we have it, that could trace these rockets back to Iran. I do believe that ultimately you are going to find that trail back to Iran's support for Hamas. It's well documented. It's historical. I think we would do well to put that information out into the public sphere to let everybody know what's actually going on here and further enhance that regional alliance structure that I was talking about here.
Now, Dr. Oren confirmed what I had seen, which is at the beginning of this, when it was a Temple Mount problem and riot, that some of the Abraham Accord partners with Israel wavered, including Bahrain, but that once Hamas attacked Tel Aviv and central Israel, the Hamas alienated the Abraham Accord partners who were concerned with attacks on the Temple Mount and Dome of the Rock. That would be reassuring. However, there's a lead headline in the Times of Israel today that Team Biden is trying to have it every way that they can. They want to be friends with Hamas. They want to be friends with Iran. They want to be friends with the Israelis, but it's not working. You can't be friends with everyone in the Middle East.
You can't. And, you know, we had earlier a readout from a conversation between the National Security Advisor and their Israeli counterpart that prior to this violence occurring, that said the United States was expressing serious concern about a pending eviction of a number of Palestinian families from their homes in a certain neighborhood in Jerusalem, and then the violent clashes on the Temple Mount. And again, I think this is a situation where the administration can't try and be too cute and thread some impossible needle through all of this. It's as simple as standing by your friends and punishing your enemies. And our friends are Israel. We have other allies in the region, and our enemies are Iran and Salafi jihadist terrorist groups like Hamas. And it's that simple. We have to support our friends and punish our enemies. And we have to build our entire regional approach based on that simple framework. And that's what the Trump administration did quite effectively. And I think even their harshest critics have to give them credit for the historic cooperation between Israel and Saudi Arabia and other Sunni Arab Gulf states. And so to reject that approach, to me, just makes absolutely no sense. And Hugh, as I've said many times on your program before, ultimately, I think it screws up all of your broader foreign policy ambitions, because this won't just be the Middle East, right? Vegas rules do not apply to the Middle East. What happens there does not stay there. What happens there will create chaos that will build upon itself and screw up any effort to focus more intently on the Indo-Pacific, on the rise of China, and look at China's advancements and investments in the Middle East itself and its attempts to bolster Iran's position in Iraq, for example, the agreements it's signing with Iran. So they've chosen to put themselves on the other side of the alliance structure. So it's time for us to really firm up that basic network of friends and allies that we have in the region. Otherwise, the violence is going to get worse and worse and worse.
You know, the one mistake you made there is that you can't imagine the Biden administration doing X. They've already done X. They've already tried to have it both ways. I can imagine them doing anything. The same voices in that administration, Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken, are outnumbered by the appeasers. Let me turn to the pandemic. Yesterday, I interviewed Niall Ferguson at length about his book, Doom, which I recommend to you strongly. The podcast is 70 minutes long. People can go to the interview with Hugh Hewitt to listen to it. The key part of that was a virus variant that eludes our vaccine is a black dragon, as he calls it. If we have to go back to ground zero because a variant emerges, the place it will likeliest emerge is India or Brazil. We have to be doing everything we can to rush vaccines, not only because it's a humanitarian crisis in India, Brazil, but also that's the breeding ground of the variant of which we have to be most afraid. Do you think we're doing everything we can?
No, I don't. And first of all, Neil's work is incredible. And he's someone I continue to look to for thoughtful commentary, particularly on U.S.-China relationships. And I look forward to reading the book. But I don't think we're doing everything we can. I think, as we talked about briefly last week, I'm concerned about this sort of intellectual property waiving approach that we've taken. I think sort of the alternative approach involves boosting American manufacturing to the maximum extent possible and then sending those vaccines to our allies and friends and partners that are in trouble. And you named, you know, India, of course, is at the top of that list right now, because I do worry about giving the Chinese Communist Party access to this remarkable technology that you could look at as a dual use technology. Right. This could be weaponized against us in the future. So that sort of dual approach of bolstering our manufacturing capability, conducting vaccine diplomacy with what we produce while also protecting American innovation and preventing the dual-use nature of this technology spreading to our enemies is critically important. And ultimately, that helps our public diplomacy, right? Because the Chinese vaccine sucks. It's not working, right?
The Seychelles are reporting a 37% outbreak, and they're using the China vaccine, which doesn't work.
Exactly. So America, in partnership with some European countries and allies, created this incredible technology. We now need to leverage that in order to save the world, if I could put it in the most dramatic terms possible. That should be a win-win-win for us, but we got to do it smartly without giving away the innovation that went into this.
Well, I actually am in favor of whatever approach puts more jabs in arms and protecting, if we have to give the patents away, protecting the places where it's produced in India. Let me close by asking you, Congressman Gallagher, about the possibility that this spirals in India into some kind of conflict with China, because they've effectively poisoned the subcontinent. And then they blamed the United States for it, and they covered it up. As Neil's book spreads and warns of gain of function spread, you were very upset about gain of function not being asked of Tony Fauci on the weekend. Do you think India begins to consider that China poisoned it?
Well, if you look, the Wolf Warrior diplomats in China are all over social media, really ridiculing India as they're dealing with this devastating outbreak. You can look, they've tweeted out pictures of, they put a rocket ship in one picture saying, this is how you light a fire in China. And then in another picture, they had, you know, burning related to the pandemic in India saying, this is how you do it in India. Just shaming India during this crisis. If you remember, there was hand-to-hand combat between India and China last year that resulted in deaths of Indian soldiers. So tensions are clearly escalating. Anyone who looks at this issue knows that really the critical piece of the puzzle as we build an alliance structure that is, India is not a formal ally to counter China, is India. So we have to be doing everything possible to keep them on our side and help them deal with economic coercion, ideological warfare from the Chinese Communist Party against them. And it starts right now with helping them through this crisis. And yes, on Fauci, for the love of God, can someone please just ask him whether U.S. taxpayer dollars went to gain of function research in the Wuhan lab? As you know, the second
I did ask him, he said no. I asked him 2 weeks ago. He said no, but Josh Rogan suspects he wasn't being candid with me. Mike Gallagher, good to talk to you, Congressman. Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Brian Westbury of First Trust Portfolio. I call him America's economist. You can read his blog. I just tweeted it out over at First Trust Portfolio. Good morning, Brian. I have five headlines to read for you and then listen to you digest them. From the Wall Street Journal, stocks fall as Dow posts worst day since February. From the Financial Times, Wall Street ends lower as inflation debate intensifies. From the Wall Street Journal, U.S. home prices surge, scaring off potential buyers. From the Wall Street Journal, U.S. job openings reach record as hiring slows. And from the Financial Times, billionaire Peter Thiel and Alan Howard back new $10 billion crypto exchange. To that, I would add, I can't buy gasoline in Northern Virginia. What's up, Brian? This does not look good.
Man, there are so, I mean, you're right. Those headlines are, you put them all together and you go, what the heck is going on out there? We, when government is as big as it is right now, I believe you get all kinds of almost indigestible things happening. You know, people think, many people think the government can run everything, but all it really does is create major problems. So for example, last Friday, we had an employment report. Everyone thought that the number was going to come in huge, over 1 million jobs. I'm sure you talked about it for the month. And we only had about 250,000 jobs. And the reason is unemployment benefits are so generous that, that employers are having a hard time bringing workers into the workforce. And so one of the things that happened is people thought, well, maybe the economy is slow, and it is, but we're going to eventually get those jobs anyway. It's just all about a timing issue. And when you end up with states on one hand cutting these benefits off, like Montana, North Carolina, on another hand, in California with Governor Newsom adding more to these benefits with an election coming up, I think people start to get confused about what's really going on and who can survive. And so, when I look at the economy today, we have better news on the virus, on hospitalizations, deaths, cases. The Fed is printing money like crazy, and we're spending money like crazy. And so we will have 1 month things where people analyze the data, come to the conclusion that something's going wrong, but in the end, the economy this year is going to boom. Now we're running out of gas in Virginia because the pipeline was cyber attacked. And one of the things that happens when government gets involved in an economy is you actually become more vulnerable. One of the first things the Biden administration did was end the Keystone Pipeline. Well, that makes us more vulnerable to this other pipeline. And so when government's managing the economy, you're going to get headlines that sound, that in fact detail things that aren't good. But in my belief, eventually the market figures out a way to get those goods to us, to get those jobs in people's hands, to get people back to work.
Brian, I am, for disclosure for the audience, I'm long on Amazon, and I'm about as long as long can be on Amazon. Yesterday, Amazon did a bond offering, 2 days ago now, that was the lowest differential between the U.S. Treasury of the same period and a private company ever. Is Amazon becoming the new reserve currency? I mean, that was astonishing what happened.
Yeah, that's where, right now, when I'm doing a speech these days, this is the line I start with. And on one hand, this is the easiest time I have ever had to forecast. Now, I heard all the headlines that you mentioned. I tried to at least make sense of some of them. But it's the easiest because we're printing all this money, shoving, government spending and borrowing from the future into people's hands that they get to spend. And that means the economy is going to boom. And plus, we're reopening after a pandemic. These are all unprecedented things. Amazon wins in every way possible. I mean, if you think about paying people to sit on the couch instead of get a job, well, that makes it really hard for mom and pop retailers to open up. And Amazon just keeps winning. They were open the whole pandemic. They keep winning. So the risk of investing in that company, buying their bonds, buying their stock, has just basically gone away. And that's what the market is saying, that right now it's easy to forecast. There isn't going to be a recession. Amazon is going to be able to pay back those bonds. So therefore, you don't get a spread. You get it's basically like buying a treasury. The odds of not being repaid are basically zero right now.
Wow. Yeah, you know, Brian, I can't. We got to talk at length next week. You made sense out of a nightmare, a meteor storm of headlines. I love talking to you. Follow him on Twitter at Westbury. Go to Hugh Hewitt on Twitter. I link to his daily blog. He is America's economist, and he's right here on the Hugh Hewitt Show weekly. I'll come back hour three straight ahead, America. Stay tuned. It's the hour of three senators, Cruz, Hagerty, and Cotton. Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. The NFL just released its new schedule. The Browns open against the Chiefs week one, 4:25 in the afternoon, a preview of the AFC championship next year. The Titans are nowhere to be found, and Tennessee Senator Bill Hagerty joins me now. He's probably sad that the Titans get no love from the NFL. But, you know, Senator Hagerty, there is a season to everything, and this is the season for the Browns.
Well, last time we spoke, you asked me to convey your regards to Jimmy D. Haslam. I did. They are very appreciative of you, Hugh, and I think they're very happy with where the Browns are right now.
We are very happy. I am not happy, though, with where Israel is. And I want to draw on your experience as former ambassador to Japan, Senator. What should the United States be saying to our ally right now? Because Team Biden is all over the map on this.
Well, the messages that we're sending right now, Hugh, I think are all wrong. We should support Israel's right to defend its citizens from terrorist attacks. It's Iranian-backed terrorists from Gaza that are rocketing innocent citizens there right now. And it's this whole effort to enter the failed Iran nuclear agreement that I think is precipitating this rogue regime, you know, who are back funding terrorists in Gaza. We're sending all the wrong messages that we want to appease, that we want to cajole. We want the Iranians to come back into this bad deal. The real aggressors here are the Iranians. They're the ones that are fueling this. And, you know, our rhetoric here is emboldening terrorists like Hamas because they think they've got support from the international community now. And we should be backing our allies as strongly as we can. What is clear is that the political rhetoric from America is heard around the world. And we are, you know, part and parcel and responsible for this.
Now, Senator, I want to get to the border in a moment, but I want to ask your opinion of the appointment of your successor, Rahm Emanuel, who is going to be very powerful in this administration. He's going to become the ambassador to Japan, former mayor of Chicago, former close colleague of then Vice President Biden in the Obama White House when Rahm Emanuel was chief of staff. What do you make of his appointment? Is it good for Japan?
Well, I, to be clear about this, I've heard the same things you have, that he is to be nominated. That has not yet formally happened. I'll just say this. The appointment of an ambassador to Japan is a very serious decision. We have more military stationed in Japan than any place else in the world. Japan is our buffer against China, Russia, North Korea. It's an incredibly strategic position. And as ambassador there, whomever is decided or whomever is selected and confirmed by the Senate, they are going to be the United States representative, the senior American in a region that is extremely challenged right now, particularly when you think about China. So I'm going to be looking at this nomination very carefully. I want to certainly see us continue to succeed in that region. And whomever the Biden administration actually puts forward, and again, that isn't finalized, I'm going to be scrutinizing that post extraordinarily carefully.
Now, Senator Hagerty, yesterday, historian Neil Ferguson was on with me. His brand new book, Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe, is a must read. He believes that China may very well move against Taiwan after the Winter Olympics in a kind of replay of what Putin did in Crimea and Ukraine after their Winter Games. Are you that alarmed about the calendar between the Chinese Communist Party and Taiwan?
You and I have spoken about Taiwan before. I am very concerned about what's happening in the region right now. China continues to step up their military aggression. You know, China is a predator on so many dimensions, but militarily, they have increased their military expenditures eightfold over the past couple of decades. What's happened with the rest of their, you know, neighbors out there? Nothing. We have got to take this threat seriously. We have got to step up our presence in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. We have the 7th Fleet based out there right now. We have got to continue to show American strength and American resolve. Taiwan is our ally. And China continues to rattle the chain with respect to what they might do with Taiwan. If you look at what's happening with Hong Kong, I mean, China has moved much more aggressively toward Hong Kong, violated their international agreements. Look at what's happening with the Uyghur population. They have moved incredibly aggressively against them. I mean, it's genocide that's occurring there. So should we be concerned? Absolutely. Am I watching it closely? You better believe it.
Now, let's ask why the senator from Tennessee was in Guatemala recently. What's that all about, Senator Hagerty?
That's about the urgency that I feel that the Senate feels about what's happening south of our border. Mine was the first official delegation to visit a foreign country since the pandemic shut everything down. Why did I go there? Because we've got an absolute crisis at our southern border. And I went to Guatemala. I met with the president, with the foreign minister there. I went to Mexico to meet with their foreign minister, their economic minister, to really get to the bottom of what's happening and to begin to come to conclusions about what we need to do to resolve this.
What is that? Because, I've been emailing with Chris Landau, our former ambassador to Mexico, was very successful in his tenure in Mexico City.
Chris was a great ambassador. Yeah, he represented us so well there.
I don't know what's happened. What has broken down? Because obviously all the agreements that were in place with Guatemala and Mexico under the Trump administration have vanished.
Yeah, they in almost a knee-jerk fashion, they came in and tore up agreements that had been very hard fought, very hard negotiated, years of negotiation to get to the migrant protection protocols, the so-called Stay in Mexico program. How much effort did it take to get the wall built, under construction, and funded? And by the way, the Congress has funded the wall. There's something called the Impoundment Act that does not allow the administration to stop building, stop utilizing the funds that we have programmed and approved. There's a tremendous concern on my part that the Biden administration is thumbing its nose and ignoring the explicit direction of Congress. But I think the most important lesson that I took away from the visit, Hugh, is that when American leaders speak, foreign countries listen. They heard a candidate Biden say, hey, if I win, we'll treat you better. That creates hope in the minds of people who are desperate. And also, it creates an ability for the so-called coyotes, the people that smuggle human beings across the border. That's a marketing slogan for them. When you say, I'm going to impose a 100-day moratorium on deportations, that's like saying I've got a blue light special at Kmart. You better get it done quick. But that creates a sense of urgency. And then when you talk about $15 minimum wage, $1,400 of stimulus checks for illegal immigrants, COVID vaccinations for everyone, all of this is creating a giant magnet, false hope. You know, we're not going to have a $15 minimum wage. I can tell you, Hugh, that's not going to pass the Senate. But that's what's being marketed to very vulnerable people south of the border.
Now, Senator, I got to ask you, in terms of the inflationary effect of additional spending, I did all the headlines for the last 2.5 hours about the markets being in an uproar because of this inflationary spike we see everywhere. And yet we can't buy gas in Northern Virginia because of the pipeline cyber attack. And I am curious, do some of your Democratic colleagues realize now is not the time to spend $4.5 trillion? Maybe the serious infrastructure solution that Senator Capito is negotiating on behalf of the Republicans, but $4.5 trillion, that will turn a bonfire into an inferno.
Hugh, you're exactly right. They just need to look at what's happening to the 10-year Treasury to see that directionally this has been moving toward inflation ever since this talk of rampant stimulus has begun. And if we don't put a stop to this now, we're going to be in the old stagflation days of Jimmy Carter. Do I think the Democrats care about this? No. I think they're trying to push forward as much as they can inside this narrow window that they've got. This narrow window meaning this 2-year window from the time that Biden was appointed. They took 50-50 position in the Senate. And what is it, a 6-person hold over the House of Representatives right now?
Yeah.
It's the narrowest control you could imagine. Yet they're using this as an opportunity to fundamentally transform America. Do they care about the fact that they're pouring all this debt on the backs of our children and grandchildren? No. This is all about power. It's about grabbing more power for them and fundamentally transforming America, to use their view. This is something that we've got to stand up against every day. Your messaging on this, my messaging, and everyone else needs to be talking about the negative effect it's going to have on our economy, the fact this is going to set America behind.
Last question, Senator. They are proposing to end stepped-up basis, which will be a nightmare for small businesses. It's a success tax. It's a second death tax. It's a nightmare. Is that going to fly with your Democratic colleagues? We have 1 minute.
I think that when they think this one through, if they care, if it's not just another messaging effort by the Democrats to stick it to the man, if you think this one through, Hugh, the people that have capital gains will time those capital gains. They'll just try to outweigh the Biden regime. And what that does is it freezes capital in place. It means that there'll be less capital circulating in the market, less capital being attracted to higher returns, less capital being attracted to opportunities that would create jobs for Americans. This is going to stifle our economy even further. The data suggests and proves that when you raise capital gains tax, when you do away with step up, you just don't receive the tax at all because people will wait you out. That's what's going to happen here. They'll freeze capital in place and it'll dampen our economy.
Senator Bill Hagerty of Tennessee, always good to talk to you, Senator. Keep coming back. I'll be right back, America. Don't go anywhere. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. I'm joined now by United States Senator Ted Cruz. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Hugh, good morning. Good to be with you.
I want to congratulate you first on endorsing and not only endorsing Glenn Youngkin. You stumped all over the Commonwealth for common sense conservatism with him, and he won. And you had a big part in that. Why did you endorse Glenn Youngkin? I did the same. I know why I did, but why did you do it?
Well, I've known Glenn for a long time. He and his wife, Suzanne, are personal friends of Heidi's and mine. We've spent time with them. We've stayed at their house. We are our friends. And he is a very impressive guy. He is a major CEO. He's been a business leader for 30 years. He's smart. He's principled. And I think he's a very attractive candidate. Virginia had been a bright red state. Sadly, it has moved sharply to the left and has become a Democratic state. And I think Glenn is by far the strongest candidate to win in November to beat Terry McAuliffe. And so I joined Glenn on the road. We stumped all over Virginia. We did, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 different stops, rallies all over the state. It was encouraging. We saw big, big crowds. Thousands of people came out to see us, and they were energized. And I was grateful that on Saturday, when the people of Virginia voted, that they agreed with you and they agreed with me. And Glenn won a resounding victory, and I think he's very well positioned to win in November, which one of the great things that you know, but you know, Virginia, with an off-cycle election, it has historically functioned as a canary in the coal mine. It is the first chance the voters have to register their views on what's happening in Washington, to register their views about what Biden and Schumer and Pelosi are doing. They're going so wildly, wildly left that historically when that happens, the voters of Virginia have typically turned to a Republican as an early sign of, hey, the train is off the rails in Washington. And I very much hope that that's what will happen in November as well.
I saw a clip of you, and you spoke to an issue near and dear to many Virginians' hearts. I am a common sense conservative. I'm supporting him because I think I live in Virginia, and the taxes just can't keep going up, and the traffic has got to get better, and the schools are a mess, and they want to do away with advanced math. I saw you speak, though, to Second Amendment rights. I got a message last night from Kurt Schlichter, my friend and occasional guest host. Is he good on Second Amendment rights? And Kurt doesn't trust me on this. I think I last fired a 22 at Camp Notre Dame in Erie, Pennsylvania 50 years ago. So I don't know anything about guns, but I think you spoke to that. He's good on the Second Amendment.
He is a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I'll tell you, I've spent time with Glenn actually on the shooting range, playing a game called Annie Oakley, where you get five guys together with shotguns and you throw up clay pigeons. And the way the game works is you toss the first pigeon and first guy shoots. If he misses, the second guy can shoot. And if he hits it, he knocks out the first guy. And, I mean, he's Glenn is a heck of a shot. But he's also he believes in the Constitution and protecting the Second Amendment. And I'm confident he'll do that.
I'm pretty sure you never want to play that game with me, Senator. All right. I want to go now to I'm just absolutely confident you don't want to be on the range with me doing that. I want to talk to you about yesterday. I talked to Neil Ferguson, great historian, eminent historian, about his book, Doom. Yep. The Politics of Catastrophe. I spent 70 minutes with him. It's over at the podcast, the interview with Hugh Hewitt. He believes, unlike most academics and historians, that we are in a Cold War with China. And that, you have to read the whole book. He saves it for the end. And he blasts everybody involved with our response to the COVID vaccine, but especially CDC and FDA. I have played a clip of your colleague, Susan Collins, yesterday, taking the bark off the CDC. Is that generally understood in the Senate that the CDC failed in January and February of last year, and they continue to fail in communicating anything remotely like common sense?
You know, I think there is a range of views on the CDC, but it is striking that yesterday you had, in the same day, you had Susan Collins and Rand Paul both unloading on the CDC. It's difficult to find two senators on the Republican side of the aisle who disagree more than Susan Collins and Rand Paul. I think that shows you the breadth of the disappointment with the CDC. Listen, I think there are some smart scientists there who do a very hard job. I also think that they have demonstrated now for a year and a half a repeated willingness to be bound more by politics than by science or reason. And their recommendations, they are whatever is politically convenient at the moment. And they don't make a whole lot of sense. And the inconsistency, you know, whatever they say today, they pretend as if nobody could remember what they said yesterday or the day before. And, you know, things like, you know, we had this week the New York Times just taking them to pieces over their assessment of the risks of passing on COVID or catching COVID outside, and the CDC had assessed it at about a 10% risk, and the New York Times, you know, hardly a conservative outlet, rarely an outlet even willing to discuss facts, but the New York Times said there's nothing in the science that backs that up. That is wildly inaccurate. The chances of catching or passing COVID outside are virtually non-existent. When the New York Times is blasting you as being too politically oriented, that's a good sign you got a problem.
That's a canary in the coal mine for misinformation. Let me turn abroad. Yeah. Israel, I spoke with Dr. Michael Oren this morning for a half hour. I've also posted that entire conversation at the Interview with Hugh Hewitt podcast. He is concerned this could escalate. This has already resulted in the first Arab-Israeli, Jewish-Israeli race riot in modern times. And it was in Lod last night. Three synagogues were burned to the ground. Do you think Team Biden is doing anything remotely like they ought to be doing in the middle of this crisis, which could become a war by the end of this show?
Well, I do think it is a powerful lesson for everyone about cause and effect and that American leadership matters. You know, we had 4 years of Donald Trump as president. And when it came to the Middle East, when it came to Israel, President Trump's approach is the one that I emphatically urged him, which is for America to stand unequivocally alongside Israel. There was a big battle early in the Trump administration about whether to move our embassy to Jerusalem. Both the State Department and Defense Department didn't want to do it. I urged the president that the right thing to do was move the embassy. He agreed, and the most powerful reason, I believe, to move the embassy was it made clear to our friends and our enemies that we stand unshakably with Israel. That led, the very same week we opened our embassy, to the most important foreign policy decision Trump made, which is pulling out of the disastrous Obama-Iran nuclear deal. Just as with the embassy, both state and defense opposed pulling out of the deal. I urged the president to pull out of the deal. He agreed with me and did. That resulted in a flowering of peace in the Middle East, the Abraham Accords, historic peace deals. I spoke to you with the foreign ministers and ambassadors of UAE and Bahrain. Both of them said virtually the identical thing as they signed the Abraham Accords. They said, it is now clear to us that America stands with Israel. We want to be friends with America. Therefore, we will be friends with Israel. And it was exactly the argument that had played out for 4 years. We saw peace in the Middle East for 4 years. What happens? Joe Biden gets elected. His number one foreign policy priority is to reinstate the catastrophic Obama-Iran nuclear deal. And they're already engaged in this strategic ambiguity where they can't decide if they're with Israel or the Palestinians. Biden has already sent over $100 million to the Palestinian Authority, which is in a unity government with Hamas, which is paying terrorists who are murdering Israelis and murdering their families, contrary to the Taylor Force Law, which I helped pass, which prohibits U.S. tax dollars from going to organizations that fund terrorists. And this is the result. The conflict we are seeing is the direct result of the tragic mistakes of the Biden foreign policy. And when you are ambiguous, when you are agonizing, when you undermine our support for Israel, what happens is it encourages the terrorists who attack and launch the kind of missile and rocket attacks that we're seeing right now. It is exceptionally dangerous. And unfortunately, I fear there's a good chance it will get worse because Biden is not going to change and is going to continue for 4 years to systematically undermine Israel.
Now, Senator, we've got 3 minutes, and I want to give you the floor as a good Supreme Court advocate. You'll hit your mark. You are leading the fight against Senate Bill 1, and boy, it needs to be defeated on many grounds. Would you tell people why? You're better at this than I am. Why does it have to be defeated?
Sure. We spent yesterday, we spent about 9 hours in an all-day markup on Senate Bill 1, which many of us are calling the Corrupt Politicians Act. It is the most radical piece of legislation before the United States Congress. It would be a federal government takeover of elections across the country. It repeals virtually every voter integrity law passed by the states all across the country. So, for example, 29 states require voter ID to vote, a common sense position that 75% of Americans support. The Corrupt Politicians Act repeals every one of those laws, makes it illegal to require voter ID. Likewise, 31 states prohibit vote harvesting, paid political operatives collecting the ballots from others because it is the most likely source of voter fraud. The Corrupt Politicians Act repeals every one of those laws, mandates ballot harvesting all across the country. The Corrupt Politicians Act automatically registers millions of people to vote, anyone who has an interaction with the government. It will result in registering millions of illegal aliens to vote. That is the intended effect, is to register millions of illegal aliens to vote. It also strikes down many states have reasonable restrictions on felons, on criminals voting. The Corrupt Politicians Act strikes all of those restrictions down because the Democrats have, quite reasonably, determined that if millions of illegal aliens vote, if millions of criminals vote, that they are likely to vote for Democrats. And the purpose of this bill is to keep Democrats in office for the next 100 years, to make it impossible for the voters to vote them out. Two other provisions of this bill, real quickly. It provides federal matching funds for the money that politicians raise for their campaign, 6-to-1 for all contributions below $200. It would be billions of dollars in welfare for politicians because the Democrats want billions of dollars in taxpayer money. And finally, it takes the Federal Election Commission, which for 50 years has been a bipartisan commission, 3 Republicans, 3 Democrats, and it turns it into a partisan weapon, 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans, which would mean it becomes the attack dog for Chuck Schumer. The purpose of this is very simple. Biden, Schumer, and Pelosi believe if this passes, the voters will not be able to defeat them, and they stay in political power for a century. And so I'm leading the fight against it, but it is as brazen a power grab, as brazen an attempt to change the rules and rig the system. And, you know, yesterday Chuck Schumer talked about Jim Crow. I pointed out Jim Crow laws were horrible. They were bigoted and they were offensive. They were written by Democratic politicians. They were enforced by Democratic politicians. And their purpose was to keep Democratic politicians in office and make it so the voters couldn't vote them out of office. This bill is Jim Crow 2.0. It's Democrats doing the same thing trying to rig the system and disenfranchise the voters. It is a horrible, horrible bill.
Well said, well argued, and on time. Senator Ted Cruz, thank you. Keep coming back. Keep fighting S1. It's got to be defeated. Thank you, Senator. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Breaking news minutes ago, the IDF identified and Shin Bet six Hamas senior leaders killed in reprisals against the Gaza terrorist organization. I'm joined by Senator Tom Cotton. Senator Cotton, what do you think of what's going on in Israel, the Biden administration's response, and what should the United States be doing right now?
Well, we should be doing more to stand by our close ally, Israel, and the Israeli people. They're being attacked once again with hundreds of rockets and mortars fired from terrorist organizations like Hamas, likely backed by Iran. It's possible they may need a resupply for their missile defense systems. We should certainly be forward-leaning on that, and we should condemn these attacks and make it clear that we'll do whatever it takes to help Israel protect itself.
The first action by Team Biden was to have National Security Advisor Sullivan call his counterpart in Israel and ask for de-escalation. That was roundly criticized in Israel. What do you think of it, Senator Cotton?
Yeah, that was disgraceful to call on the government of Israel, democratically elected by its own people, to stand down in the face of terrorist assaults. The only people escalating the attacks here are Hamas terrorists who are firing these missiles at innocent civilians. Israel and the Israeli Defense Forces go to the ends of the earth to protect civilian life, whereas Hamas and terrorist organizations like Hamas intentionally use civilians to protect themselves.
Now, Senator Cotton, Senator Cruz was just on. You were part of that hearing on S1 yesterday. What do we make of this bill? Does it have any chance of passing?
Well, what to make of it is the Democrats are worried that they can't win elections in the future because their agenda is so radical and so far outside the mainstream. So they want to rig the rules for future elections. They want to federalize all elections and have crazy practices like mandatory mail-out ballots and ballot harvesting. Ballots are coming in up to 10 days after the election and mandatory same-day voter registration. We don't want that in Arkansas, and most states don't want it either. They run their elections perfectly well. A lot of states are working to improve their election processes right now. And not only do the Democrats not have 60 votes for this bill right now, they don't even have 50 votes for it. So as things stand now, no, we're going to stop this crazy effort to federalize our elections. And, you know, if you ask us what our response is to this bill, what we would do to federalize elections, my answer is, we don't have a bill to federalize election because we think our states and our municipalities are best situated to run elections for their own people.
Good response. Do you have similar good news on the $4.5 trillion that President Biden wants to throw on the Barbie? Really, we have inflation that is now spooking the markets and clearly present in the system, and he wants to throw fuel on the fire. Do you have good news on that?
I know, Hugh, I was just out for a run this morning, and it felt like I was going back in time. I saw at least 8 or 9 cars in line on the roads waiting to get into a gas station. So thanks, Joe Biden, for bringing back the wonderful 70s. You have gas lines and inflation. I think more and more Democrats in Congress are getting worried about their reckless spending and their taxes that are going to crush our economic recovery, especially in light of the very disappointing jobs report from last week. We will see how some key meetings of our leadership with people like Mitch McConnell and Shelley Moore Capito go at the White House this week. But again, I think right now the Democrats are beginning to worry about what the future holds for them. They continue down this headlong path of more taxes and more spending, which is going to lead more inflation, fewer jobs.
I believe the leader has offered hard infrastructure, and Senator Capito is negotiating that. Would that include the Shipyard Act? Because we actually do need to upgrade the shipyard, Senator Cotton.
Yeah, I hope so, Hugh. I support the legislation, sponsor the legislation that will invest billions of new dollars in our shipyards to help expand our Navy. I think it is amazing. It is truly amazing that in proposing $6 trillion, think about that, Hugh, $6 trillion of new spending, which is more than the government spends in a single year on everything combined, the Democrats couldn't find a few nickels rolling around the federal government's proverbial cushions to spend on defense. And in fact, defense is getting a cut in Joe Biden's budget this year. So we shouldn't be spending this money to begin with. But if we are going to spend that much money, we certainly need to invest in our military and make sure that we are accelerating the programs that are going to help recapitalize our Navy and our Air Force, modernize our Army, and make sure our troops now and in the future have the very best cutting-edge technology and weapons to keep our country safe.
Senator Cotton, I got a rebuke when I said they were cutting defense from one of my friends in the Biden White House. Said, oh, no, the top line's going up. To which you respond?
Inflation, Hugh. I mean, it's about to be a pretty big cut when inflation gets even higher. But look, there's a clear direction that the military needs to go. Democrats and Republicans alike have agreed on this for years, is that you need 3 to 5% real growth. That means 3 to 5% over inflation. The budget is relatively flat this year, which means even under past inflation measures, it's going to be declining in real terms. Under what inflation looks like it's going to be in the next year, it's going to be declining even more.
A massive cut. I mean, if everything is going up and the basic commodities are going up, the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Air Force will be crippled. Senator Cotton, good to talk to you. Hope that run was fast. Hope the weather is good because I'm going out now. Senator Tom Cotton, follow him on Twitter at SenTomCotton. Don't forget, at the interview with Hugh Hewitt, this morning's long interview with Michael Oren from Israel on events on the ground there. Yesterday's long interview with Neil Ferguson about his book, Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe, a must-listen-to podcast. Go and listen to them both at the interview with Hugh Hewitt. I'll be back tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.